The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening. And enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. As always, I'm your host and narrator, Eric Peabody. Tonight, we've got a story from A.W. Mason titled The Shack, and in my opinion, it's the perfect summer story. After all, what screams on break from college more than an interstate road trip with some friends? Bruce, Jane, and Mark are driving up to New Hampshire to visit Bruce's family. So far, the weather has been mild, the scenery gorgeous, and they've been handling the long drive in Bruce's cramped Pontiac with aplomb. Of course, any extended travel is fraught with at least a few little frustrations, and as night starts to fall, Jane realizes that she has forgotten to bring a camera. After hunting around for a place that's still open, they stumble across a run-down little store in the middle of nowhere. Now, listeners, you know how these stories tend to go, so I'll ask you. Do you think it's a good idea if they stop? I think we all know the answer to that one. Also, please join me in welcoming Danielle Hewitt back to the show, performing several roles in tonight's story. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author A.W. Mason, I give you The Shack. Before. The old car's back tires spun like insane merry-go-rounds, spitting up soft earth and gravel as the young man punched the accelerator. The pale woman in the seat beside him groped at her neck with both hands, trying to cover the deep, wet gash across her trachea. Her attempts to suck in air produced a gurgling noise that showered streams of blood through her weak fingers. Her blouse slowly turned from yellow to deep purple to black. Behind them, the old man squinted and watched as the car sped off, trying to see which way they would go. The complete blackness that night did nothing to aid his deteriorating vision. He let out a grunt and kick-started the ancient heavy motorcycle, revving it to a go, then chased after the car.
"It's going to be all right. We'll get you to a hospital. Just Hang in there, baby,
the young man said, wiping the wetness from under the hollows of his eyes. In front of him, the road glistened in the dim headlights of the car. Sheets of rain had left the ditches on either side of him with standing water, the asphalt slick and damp. Not far off, the rumble of loud exhaust echoed against the trees flanking the moat-like ditches. The car took to sliding around corners as the young man looked up into the rear view to see the motorcycle catching up at a quick pace. Muscles in his right leg groaned, but he kept the go pedal down as far as the unforgiving pavement afforded him. Beneath his sweaty arm, the old man reached for his shoulder holster and removed a revolver. He checked the cylinder. 5 rounds left. With a swift snap of his wrist, the cylinder locked back into place. Raising the revolver to eye level, he aimed at the car's left rear tire and pulled the trigger. The bullet skidded off the soaked pavement like a firework gone awry, leaving a light trail in the night air. The car swerved at the sound of the shot. 4 tries left now. The bike lurched forward, throttle full bore. The car came back into focus enough for the old man to take another shot. He took aim again and fired, squeezing his weathered thighs to the bike's frame to maintain balance from the shot's recoil. This time, direct hit. Rubber tread flapped wildly from the punctured tire before flying off into the side of the road, disappearing into the water-filled ditch. The car skidded around like a falling ice skater. Sparks flew from the bare metal wheel carving into the asphalt, the young man's face becoming flush as new beads of sweat formed on his brow and upper lip. 3 shots left now. The old man shifted the bike into another gear, producing a guttural bang. The chase had escalated to 70 miles per hour. He lifted the gun again and shot. The bullet ripped through the cab, shattering the back window and splitting the front. Shit! The young man yelled out, trying to correct the understeer caused by the tireless rim. 2 bullets left now. These had to count, the old man mused. He pulled his bike into the left lane to get a clearer shot at the gas tank. However, once parallel to the car, he looked up, cut the throttle, and braked, screeching to a halt. The old man on the motorcycle saw something that the car's young passengers had not. Looking out, the young man met a pair of yellowish eyes floating in the darkness, belonging to some nocturnal creature, or perhaps a deer or an elk. He didn't know which. His mind didn't have time to register whatever it was he was about to become entangled with. He mashed the brakes, sending the car sideways on the slick pavement, filling up both lanes. As the car got closer, the young man understood the yellowish eyes belonged to a large deer frozen on the roadway. They collided with a sickening thud as the car careened off the road and into a ditch. It shot up through the wet earth before smashing into a thick oak tree. The front end of the vehicle wrapped around the sturdy trunk like a hook. The remaining part of the windshield covered the crumpled hood like tiny diamonds. Both occupants inside lay limp. The old man cranked up his bike and edged closer to the wreckage. He stopped, 30 feet away, and raised his left hand perpendicular to his chest. He put his shooting arm on top, steadying his aim. The young man lifted his blood-smeared forehead from the steering wheel, squinting over at the girl. She was no longer gripping her neck. Instead, her body slumped over on its side, her motionless face plastered to the dashboard. The radiator hissed like a boiling tea kettle, but all the young man could think about was his aching head. His temples throbbed. He reached for a seatbelt. Behind him, he spied the old gunslinger sitting on his bike. 2 bullets remaining. The old man closed his left eye again, looked down the revolver's barrel, and shot. A blazing yellow-orange firebolt escaped the gun's muzzle, sending the searing slug through the sheet metal of the car's gas tank. A little trickle, then a stream of pungent fuel poured from the bullet hole. The old man reached his gun back toward the holster and watched in sadistic pleasure as a flame ignited at the rear of the car. The young man saw the fire and felt the warmth of its glow, compounding the ache in his head. The pace of his breath grew faster. He tried the door handle, but it seemed jammed. The entire driver's side of the car was crunched up from the wreck, and he was pinned inside. The old man smiled as he watched the young man beat on the ashy door window. In a shock of pure irony, the glass had somehow stayed intact during the wreck. Of course, the old man couldn't hear it through the growing roar of the fire, but the last thing he saw from the young man trapped inside was the labored stretching of his mouth, a blood-curdling scream for help, stifled by the chaotic environment. The car became engulfed by the flames and drowned out the image of the young couple inside. Moments later, the wreckage exploded, sending pieces of the hood high into the dark, humid air. The old man watched the afterburn for a while, then started the bike again. "Good," he said, then turned around and sped off. 1. 2 days earlier. Bruce fidgeted with the knobs on the old factory AM/FM radio. He hadn't found good reception since their last stopover 3 hours ago. Just static and the brief, sporadic sputtering of tired Bible Belt sermons. He turned the volume knob to the left until it clicked off, silencing the radio. "Hey man, turn it back on," Mark said from the back seat. Sitting in the cramped rear of a 68 Pontiac was less than desirable, but at least the music kept him entertained, even though the back speakers worked intermittently.
"Mark, all we've gotten is static. Give it a rest,"
Jane said, rolling her eyes at their backseat companion in the rear view. She twirled a finger through her long, dishwater blonde hair. Bruce put his hand on her thigh and gave it a gentle squeeze. She looked over at him, offering a Mona Lisa smile. Vibrant green foliage blurred past them as they roared through the countryside. Mark pouted into the rearview mirror and crossed his arms. Reaching for the radio again, Bruce glanced at the gas gauge. Almost empty. "Jesus, it does not pay to drive an 8-cylinder. He scrolled around the dial for a clear station, one of them finally coming in.
Oh, keep it here. It's that new song from Judas Coin," Mark said.
He leaned between the two front bucket seats to get a better listen.
"Yeah, sure, buddy,"
Bruce said, trailing off and scanning the freeway for some place to stop.
"Could both of you keep your eyes peeled for a gas station? We're about to be running on fumes."
The trio passed a few lodging and food signs, but nothing in the way of refueling. Bruce knew there'd be more gas stations along the way before arriving in New Hampshire, but still tightened his grip on the steering wheel, looking forward through the windshield as if in a daze. His knuckles turned white. New Hampshire made him nervous. They had all made the trip before, usually to visit Bruce's folks and get away from the city for a break. This time, however, felt different, stomach-churning even. He patted the ring in his left-side pants pocket, hoping he didn't appear anxious. Yet, he felt the anxiety building inside him, or perhaps it was just having Mark along for the ride. Like a road-trip weary child from the back seat, Mark cried,
"Okay, now I'm getting hungry, and I gotta piss so bad my back teeth are floating."
He made an imaginary grab to his groin like a youngster might do when it's time for a potty break. Another blue information sign loomed on the horizon. The sun-faded metal made it difficult to read, but a little cartoon gas pump started to take shape, as luck would have it. Food, lodging, and gas. Exit 49 to the rescue. Bruce pulled into a gas-and-go and cut the rumbling beast's engine. Mark jumped out and beelined to the little convenience store, stirring up miscellaneous food wrappers littering the back seat like a miniature tornado. Bruce grinned and shook his head. The fuel hatch creaked as it opened, and from it, the ghost-like vapors of gasoline danced past in transparent waves.
"Do you want anything from inside, hun?"
Jane asked. Bags had started to form under her eyes. Bruce stared at her, admiring the glow of her soft skin, eye bags included. He held the pump mechanism with one hand because the hold latch was broken,
while his free hand continued to roam about his left pants pocket.
No, I'm fine. Thanks.
She smiled and gave him a wink, hips swaying as she meandered into the store. Bruce watched the numbers next to the dollar sign on the pump increase. After it finished, the digital readout totaled $20.80.
Man, only 13 gallons, Bruce whispered. 2003, what a time to be alive.
He whistled as he went inside and paid. 2. 10 minutes back into the trip, Jane groaned and slapped her forehead with her palm. She slumped back in her seat.
What?
Mark asked at the smacking sound. The radio had again gone kaput, and he took to counting the cows grazing in the fields as they drove on. So far, he was up to 12.
I forgot to buy a disposable camera back at the gas station. I wanted to take pictures of our trip and send some with the letters I've been writing to my mom.
About the time Jane started seeing Bruce on a steady basis, she also connected with her birth mother after an exhausting search almost turned up nothing. Her mother's name was Grace, and she lived in California. It was a slow start at first. Grace didn't own a computer, and mail from one side of the coast to the other ran about as quick as a one-legged man in quicksand. The biggest challenge, however, was convincing Grace that Jane was the child she bore all those years ago, and that Jane had wanted to be in any kind of relationship with her biological mother at all. Shock and grief alone nearly shut down their fledgling correspondence, but Jane had an enigmatic way with people. He glanced at his girlfriend, fiancé if the trip went well, and recognized the look. Big doe eyes, rosy cheeks, bottom lip protruding out so much it looked like a second tongue. As the navigator, Bruce crunched some numbers in his head. They were ahead of schedule so far. Stopping again so soon wouldn't hurt their excellent time. A few minutes off course seemed easier to handle than an angry little lady.
We'll stop at the next exit.
Jane leaned over and planted a wet kiss on his cheek. Mark didn't care either way. He had to piss again. 3. The off-ramp wound around scattered trees and bushes, becoming more and more rural as the Pontiac continued down the road. Other than the foliage, the scenery didn't offer much. Some old jalopies and boarded-up houses. None of the yards were kept. Overrun weeds turned them into suburban jungles. Even with a facelift, Bruce thought, this place would still look like a set piece from Nightmare on Elm Street.
Where are we?
Mark asked. He held up the road atlas, staring at the Pennsylvania freeway system as if it were full of hieroglyphics. Outside, the dull orange sun sank into the ground, painting the sky violet, the purplish clouds dancing around.
We took exit 57, right? I don't even see it on the map anywhere.
Bruce slowed to a stop and rubbed his chin. A gust of wind blew ancient fallen leaves across the roadway.
This place is a dump.
Oh, wait, look.
Jane pointed in the direction of an old 76 station. About a mile down the road, even in the waning light, the burnt orange ball with the navy blue script was easy to spot. Bruce drove the car up to the station, but akin to everything else in the town, emptiness loomed. Boarded up and abandoned, occupants long gone. The gas pumps remained, sticking out like monuments to yesteryear, but Bruce doubted if they worked. He also doubted that they would find any disposable cameras for sale inside the station. He looked over at Jane. Fatigue and defeat crept into her posture like a ghost as she seemed to melt into her seat. Those translucent little purple bags under her eyes had grown since this morning, and he noticed she had been blinking more often, as if trying to communicate in some other language. The 13 straight hours on the road began to wear on all of them.
I'm sorry, Jane. Bruce placed his hand on top of hers. Maybe we can get one tomorrow. Plus, we could probably use some rest anyway. You want to go on a little farther and find a place, stop for the night?
Jane didn't look up. She had a feeling Bruce wanted to make the trip straight through, so she said yes. The camera could wait,
and this place started to give her the creeps. It had already felt like hours had passed since they had departed the freeway.
"I say we beat feet and get somewhere civilized,"
Mark spoke up from the back seat. "We can probably find a cheap motel down the road."
"We could all use the rest," Bruce concurred.
They backed out of the deserted gas station and drove off in the direction they first came, intending to get back on the freeway to locate another blue information sign, one that was more up to date with its amenities. However, the farther they traveled, the more the road seemed to stretch on and on, no freeway on-ramp appearing.
"Guys, did we miss..." "Whoa, whoa, whoa! What's that?"
Mark asked, pointing out the window at a small roadside building. Building, perhaps, was a bit of a misnomer. The structure looked more like a hut or a derelict shack. It appeared dark, except for some strewn-up lights that may have been of the Christmas variety some years ago. They almost resembled tiny, red-hot, glowing chilies. The faux chilies wrapped around the entire perimeter of the shack, drooping around portions of the mossed-over roof. The only other lighted item on property was a blue and red neon open sign in the front window, partially covered by dirty blinds.
"Whatever it is," Mark said, "it's open."
The exterior looked as if made from ancient wooden planks, like buildings in old spaghetti westerns. The shingled roof sagged, probably from years of heavy snow and ice. A weathered, galvanized smokestack bellowed out white tendrils of smoke against the darkening sky. Toward the entrance hung what looked like a dozen rows of strung onions or garlic, stretching from gutter to ground. At the front of the hut, connected to the main byway, sat a gravel lot. Two cars rested there, one a late 70s Ford pickup, and the other a mid-90s Ford Contour. Both looked spray-painted, the Contour with yellow and blue, like someone had attempted to give them a cheapo paint job. Farther down, a litany of old bowling balls lined the perimeter of the parking lot, only the balls didn't have finger holes, just plain balls.
"What is this place?"
Jane asked, peering out the car window. Her mouth hung open as she ogled the scenery. Bruce heard the subtle quiver in her voice.
"No clue," he said, parking and getting out of the vehicle.
The front door of the establishment swung open, slamming into the rickety facade. At once, all three looked in the direction of the noise. An old man came hobbling out, limping, bow-legged. The shirt he wore barely covered his protruding belly. His pants, the kind with the all-forgiving elastic band, showed signs of deep wear around the knees and waist, staying up around his bulbous midsection with the architectural support of his suspenders. A 5-day white whisker beard covered his pockmarked face, and his hair, wild around the parts of his head that were still winning the battle of the bald, looked like it had been combed with a firecracker.
"Maybe we should leave,"
Jane said, watching the old man limp towards the car.
"Hold on a minute, babe."
The old man made his way to the Pontiac, taking in large mouthfuls of air as he strode up the gravel.
"Hey there, don't get too many visitors this time of night,"
the old man said. He grinned, exposing a gap-toothed smile. What little teeth he did have left looked ready to uproot and go searching for their missing friends.
"Hey, that's a nice car," he said, pointing at Bruce's ride.
"Thanks. It's a 68 Pontiac GTO. Bought it when I was 16. Been fixing her up ever since."
Bruce put a hand on his baby, baby number two, sliding his hand down the front as if to claim his territory. The old man squinted his eyes and raised a hand to his beard, scratching it as he eyed the group.
"Well, that's a nice car, boy. By the way, name's Bill Ruskin, but y'all can call me Rusky,"
he said, extending a liver-spotted hand. Bruce shook it and introduced his friends and told him about their camera ordeal from earlier in the day.
"Need a camera, eh? Huh, believe I got me some of them in the shop," he said, crooking a thumb back toward his little hut. "On the back wall there inside. You can go take a look if you wanna."
Bruce motioned for Mark and Jane to get out of the car so they could go look inside the building.
"So, what you think about my pickup? It's a classic, just like yours,"
Rusky said, smiling again. Bruce looked toward the old, aging pile of sheet metal and tires. The truck was a two-tone, red and rust. The bed had a bungee cord spanned from one side to the other, holding the pieces together while stretching the limits of gravity.
"Yeah, I'm not really into trucks or newer cars for that matter," he said, eyeing the contour.
He looked at the price tags in the windows. $8,900 for the car and $6,700 for the truck.
"Wow," Bruce muttered. "And I don't really have that kind of cash anyway."
"But your car must have cost you a pretty penny or two. Look at them fancy wheels, and it purred like a kitty. I heard it coming in."
"I did it all myself. Worked on it here and there. It's taken me almost 8 years by now, but it was all done on a budget."
Rusky's lips pursed flat across his face. He kicked some gravel and then grunted. Bruce straightened up. "I didn't say anything to offend him, did I?"
"Come on," Rusky said. "Let's go see what those other two are up to."
Inside, a pungent odor akin to urine and rotting meat invaded the newcomer's olfactory senses. The shop was cluttered with lots of knickknacks and souvenirs, halting the hellacious smell from escaping, trapping it into the dank creases of plaster and linoleum. Bruce wandered the confined little space. He inventoried coolers, road maps, and atlases, a whole basket full of batteries, some packaged, some not, lawn chairs, various books and magazines, typical road trip or camping stuff, tents, lanterns, clothes. Perhaps that's why this place existed, a little pit stop for unfortunate travelers who forgot a few necessities at home, stuck paying gouged prices for their mental lapses. And clearly, this was the only place out this way to buy anything. The only place, period. Bruce kept scanning. Jewelry, sunglasses, cameras.
"These aren't really what I'm looking for,"
Jane said, staring at the back wall. The cameras were all either digital or the kind that required an actual roll of film. Nice to have, sure, but expensive.
"I just need a disposable camera, actually. Like a 27 exposure style with a flash."
Rusky foraged under the sales counter, then produced a wicker basket full of disposables, none in packaging. Jane took one from the top of the pile. It had a little lightning bolt next to the shutter. Perfect.
"Why aren't any of these in boxes?"
she asked.
"Just the way they shipped to me," Rusky explained. "Two for $20.
"No thanks. Just the one, please,"
she said, and retrieved her purse, rummaging through it for cash. The total came to $13 even, the price of late-night shopping at a dumpy little roadside shop.
"Shoot. Bruce, hun, do you have another dollar?"
she asked, still looking through her purse. Mark reached into his pocket and produced four quarters.
"Here, Jane. Say, Rusky, you know where there's a motel around here? Cheap?"
Rusky looked up at him with the same stone face he had given Bruce earlier.
"That cheapest place you're going to find around here is your car. Otherwise, keep going down SR-54, road right out front there, and you'll see a Motel 8 about 10, maybe 15 miles down."
4. They left the shack a little after the sun had completely set and headed toward the motel, according to Rusky's directions. Bruce didn't recall seeing a motel, let alone Rusky's roadside stand, when they cruised in from the freeway. Must be a little off course. The road smoothed out. They were dodging fewer potholes on this stretch, and things seemed to get a little less desolate. A city feeling? No, but at least it didn't feel like they were in a ghost town anymore. It was 9:45 when they pulled into the motel parking lot. Bruce saw a gas station across the street, probably one that sold disposable cameras, but the sign on the door read, "Closed." A 24-hour Denny's and a Walmart sat kitty-corner to the gas station.
"Motel 8, the budget-minded college student's best friend," Mark said, then patted Bruce on the back as they walked into the lobby.
A one-room, two-bed space was available, and they took it gladly. Jane used her new camera, taking pictures of the room while blinding Bruce with a bright flash. Mark devoured the little Andy's mints set out on the pillows. Always eating, that kid. Bruce picked up the mint from one of the pillows on his bed. "Fancy," he said, chuckling, throwing the chocolate to Mark. Another flash. He could hear Jane winding the camera for the next picture, but the winding sound didn't cease, as if already out of film.
"What? No more pictures? That old guy ripped me off. I think someone already used it,"
Jane said, frowning. She looked at it once more, confirming that all the film had been used, shook it, then tossed it onto the bed. After watching some of the advertised free HBO, the trio decided to go lights out. Bruce, however, stared up at the dark ceiling, stirring. Something didn't feel right. That old man, something seemed off about him, about this town, maybe even this trip. He didn't think it was cold feet. Could you even get cold feet just asking someone to marry you? He closed his eyes and drifted off to sleep. 5. Bruce opened his eyes close to noon the next day, sleeping a little longer than expected. He could hear Jane in the shower singing something unrecognizable but not unpleasant, and Mark downing what was left of a plate of bacon, presumably from some continental breakfast bar downstairs. He let out a satisfying belch and smiled at Bruce, who got out of bed, stretched, and started to pack up his things. Soon after, the motel keys were turned in and the trio hit the road again.
"Hey, can we stop and get my film developed before we get too far down the road? I'd like to mail off my letter with some pictures,"
Jane said. Bruce knew it wouldn't be a quick retreat. It would set them back at least an hour, but he said yes. They went to a one-hour photo express inside the Walmart, dropped off the disposable camera, and bummed around the store for a while, looking at things they didn't need and couldn't afford anyway. The store was desolate, employees outnumbering the customers, an unusual circumstance for the global retailer, even if the store sat squat in the middle of the sticks. The film, in turn, finished in about 40 minutes. Bruce paid the woman at the counter and gave the picture packet to Jane. She opened them up, smiling like a kid on Christmas morning. People always seem so eager to see their pictures. Funny, though, Bruce mused. In essence, they've already seen the pictures. It was from their eyes that they were created. Well, almost true for the throwaway bargain camera from Ruskies. 12 of the photos she recognized as her own. 15 of the pictures weren't of them or anyone she'd ever seen.
"I knew the old fart gave me a used camera,"
Jane said, thumbing through the pictures she hadn't taken. They looked like someone's wedding pictures. A woman, not much older than Jane, posed with her groom in most of the photos. Pictures of them at the altar, cutting cake, dancing. The photo that stood out the most displayed the wedding rings.
"Man, look at that rock," Mark said.
The diamond, a little smaller than a marble and shaped like an angular heart, shone brightly. Next to it lay his ring, a gold band with a border of little doves along the outside.
"Yeah, that guy must be loaded," Bruce suggested.
"Strange. How did that old dude get their camera?" Mark asked.
"I don't know. Maybe he found it."
They left the Walmart and drove the short distance down to the city's post office. While Jane tried to figure out the correct postage for the weight of her letter and photos, Mark and Bruce admired the wide variety of celebrity stamps. The post office had a deserted feeling to it, like every other place in this town they had visited. Above the stamp machine hung a corkboard half full of postings. Cars for sale, garage sales, missing pets and people. Bruce did a double take when he happened across one of the pictures. It was a black and white facsimile of a missing woman. Although a bit grainy, the image was clear enough to set off an alarm in his head.
"Hey, Jane, you still have those other pictures, the ones of the married couple?"
She pulled the sleeve of photos out of her purse and handed it to him. What he saw didn't make sense and gave him a nauseous feeling. He beckoned for Mark. "Look," Bruce said, handing the photo over to Mark, then motioning to the corkboard. "There's no way. I'll be a monkey's fucking uncle," said Mark. The resemblance was eerie. The woman from the local missing persons poster had to have been the same lady from the wedding photos. Had to. Mark and Bruce stood next to each other, not moving. Why was the same woman posted on the chalkboard, labeled as missing, on a camera that came from some secondhand pit stop out in the middle of nowhere? Jane finished her postage situation and called for Bruce to tell them that they could get going again. She walked by, and he grabbed her shoulder. "Look!" He stopped her. It took her a little while longer to figure out the similarities.
"It's the same woman. Dear God. The same damn woman."
Her hand began to tremble, shaking the photograph as if she had taken it with a Polaroid.
"We should call the police right away,"
she said, no hesitation in her voice. "And tell them what exactly? We have pictures of a missing girl we developed from a camera that we just so happened to have purchased from some old geezer who looks like he may be related to the Munsters?" Mark asked. Bruce wanted to laugh at his friend's comment, but that deep, burning, sick feeling in his gut halted any humor.
"Well, we have to do something. That old man probably took her stuff and has to have something to do with her disappearance,"
Jane argued. Bruce leaned on the stamp counter and put his hands on his temples. Jane was right, yet so was Mark. It might look suspicious if they went to the police about it, being in possession of the camera. The old man would deny selling it to them. And where was the husband from the wedding photos at in all of this? Was he not missing as well? Where was his missing persons bulletin? But what if she's alive? What if she's locked up in that old man's storeroom? Maybe her husband, too. Are you going to let them die? Where's your conscience at today, Brucey, old boy? "At home, where I should be," he muttered.
"What?"
Jane asked. He shook his head. "Well, what are we supposed to do here, Jane? Mark's right. We can't just go to the police and tell them we had nothing to do with this," Bruce said, immediately wishing he could take it back. Jane's stare shot daggers into his eyes. He grimaced. Jane turned around back towards the mail counter and walked up to the postmistress, who sat sorting letters. The ruffling sound of paper filled the small building.
"Excuse me, ma'am?"
Jane said, vying for the postmistress's attention again.
"What can you tell us about that missing woman up there on the corkboard? Do you know anything about her?"
The postmistress looked up at Jane, pointing toward the old black and white scan. She straightened the letters she had been filing and set them aside.
"Well, from what I can gather, that young lady and her husband came through here some years back. They was on their honeymoon heading up to Portland to visit some lighthouses and all that kind of business,"
the postmistress said. She continued,
"Only they didn't ever make it, you see. The family got all concerned after they were expected back from their trip and never showed up back home. The family even called the bed and breakfast in Portland, where they was supposed to be staying, but the proprietor said they never showed."
Proprietor came out proprieta. The postmistress licked her thumb, looked down at her remaining letters, and started sorting again. "Why isn't her husband up there too, next to her, as a missing person?" Bruce asked. He swallowed hard, and part of him didn't want to hear the response.
"Oh, the story doesn't end there, young man,"
the postmistress said.
"The family retraced all the couple's steps. Saw that they had purchased gasoline across the street from here, you know. Said so on the man's credit card statement and all. So here was the family up here, canvassing around all our little town, knocking on doors, asking if anyone had seen him or her. And truth be told, I did see him. Came in here just like you all, looking to buy some stamps. Only, we don't take cards here, so I sent them over to Walmart. They have an ATM inside, you see. Anyway, they came back in, got their stamps, and that's the last I seen of them. And that's where her trail went cold."
"So, you were the last one to see both of them?" Mark asked from behind Bruce and Jane.
Maybe the last one to see her.
The postmistress responded.
Now you'll notice I said that's where her trail went cold. No one has seen her since. At least that's what I reckon, from what I heard. The family kept retracing their steps and never got any farther. But a few weeks later, the man's credit card started being used again. Way out in Ohio, some furniture store. Police said the description of the man in Ohio using the card matched the man that came in here with his new bride. They've been looking for him ever since. I suppose there ought to be a wanted poster up there next to her with his face on it. So what? They assumed the man killed her on their honeymoon and took off to Ohio?
Jane asked.
Sweetie, it wouldn't be the first time a man had done his wife like that.
The postmistress said as she got up from her stool behind the counter. She walked over to a deposit box and tossed in the batch of letters she had been sorting.
And I bet it won't be the last time, neither.
Out in the parking lot, Jane stood, arms folded, next to the Pontiac's open passenger door. Bruce and Mark were already inside, ready to try to make up some time on the interstate. The sun turned Jane's hair into an almost fiery gold as the slight breeze whipped it around. Jane, are you all right? We're ready to hit the road, Bruce said as he looked through the windshield at his girlfriend. She didn't move. What's wrong? A hawk zipped by overhead. Jane looked up at it, noticing it had something in its talons as it flew by. She dropped her arms to her side and looked into the car.
Something still seems off about the missing girl. I don't know. It's just, it all seems wrong.
Mark leaned up from the back seat and said, Hell yeah, something was wrong. The dude offed his wife and skipped town, probably with another woman to a different state. You heard the lady in the post office. Let's get going.
No, that's not what I mean. There's got to be more to it than that. Something doesn't make sense,
Jane said. From the driver's seat, Bruce licked his chapped lips and sighed. Something was bugging him about the story as well, whether he wanted to admit it or not. He was hoping they would have all loaded into the car and got back on course, but now he felt relieved that Jane had similar feelings. It's the camera, right, Jane? Why would that old man have the camera? What was he doing with it? You both saw how many cameras he had, unboxed, sitting there for sale, Bruce said. And now we have the photos. Well, maybe they donated it to him or something like that, Mark chimed in. Maybe they visited him and needed something else and had traded the camera for it. Sweat started to show the first signs of standing out on Bruce's brow. He rolled down his window to let the air flow in.
Don't be stupid, Mark,
Jane said. Perhaps the heat was getting to her as well.
You saw her ring. I don't think they had money issues. And you know damn well that camera wasn't worth anything but those photos that were on it. He stole the damn thing.
She finally got into the car, sitting hard in the passenger seat. She craned her neck around to look at Mark, and then back to Bruce.
We have to go back. What if they're both alive and he's torturing them?
Jane said. Silence.
Oh, hell no! I ain't going back there, especially if that shit is true. That place gave me the creeps. Besides, what are we gonna do about it when we get there? Ask Rusky if he has a woman chained up somewhere? If he has a man buried out back? I say we just leave and forget we ever saw those pictures, Mark said. Now he folded his arms across his chest. Bruce had no intention of playing the hero. The shack also gave him an unnerving sense of eeriness. His mind, however, had already been made up. Fear be damned. Listen, we go back there, snoop around, and maybe find some more concrete evidence. Something that wouldn't implicate us in any sort of homicide, but really point the finger at Rusky instead, if he has actually done anything, Bruce said. Mark knew they were both right. He couldn't let this one go either, as much as he'd rather be counting cows again en route to a comfortable bed. No, Mark may have not agreed, but he would submit. So, let's get going, I guess, Mark said, hanging his head.
6. Daylight was dying when the trio pulled into the gravel parking lot once more. Bruce killed the engine and told Mark to go around back. The anxiety began to build in Bruce's mind like a steam train, yet he couldn't help but feel a tinge of silliness in his instruction to Mark. Go around back? Why? In case the bad guy tried to make an escape through a secret door? Bruce chuckled to himself, not wanting the others to hear. But Mark obeyed and trotted around to the back as Bruce and Jane walked in through the front of the shack. "This stinks," Mark said, and it did, as a foul odor invaded his nostrils. He heard the faint clanking of dull bells somewhere off toward the front of the store as his friends must have made their way in. He held his nose and continued into the thicket behind the building. To him, the area smelled like burnt hair and feces. Not a great combination. He made his way past waist-high brush, swatting at a throng of flies as he progressed. The humidity seemed at bay for now, but the insects persisted. 10 feet in front of him, a clearing appeared. It looked man-made, as if someone came through with a machete and hacked away at nature's growth. Not far into the clearing, Mark could make out 8 long piles of freshly turned dirt in the dwindling light. He edged closer. Big enough for a body, Mark thought. The smell became more intense. Mark's stomach tightened, then went loose. He had to perform a 180 and let go of his lunch. "Hello? Rusky, you here?" Bruce called out. No answer. He and Jane strolled through the dusty little shop, browsing like before, this time looking for something of use but not knowing particularly what that may be. A loud barrage of thumping came from the direction of the back room. Jane shrieked. Rusky appeared from the side counter, fat, bald, and odorous, wiping his hands together.
"Huh," he said. "You kids again, I see. Come back to make another purchase? I don't give refunds, so you can forget that if you didn't like your camera."
He looked past Jane and Bruce and scanned the rest of the store.
"Where's the other one?"
"In the car still. Pretty tired from the trip and all," Bruce said without breaking eye contact. Jane nudged up beside him, grabbing hold of his arm.
"We just needed a few more things before we hit the road again,"
Jane said, a slight waver in her voice. Rusky's eyes squinted and darted between the two, looking them up and down. His right hand fidgeted as his upper lip curled into a sneer. The curious old man asked,
"Like what?"
"Well, you know, perhaps another camera. I just love taking pictures. Maybe a keychain, some little knick-knack. Any postcards?"
Jane asked, half hoping the old man would notice her sarcastic tone. Postcards. Funny, Bruce thought. Hopefully, the kind not already written on by dead people.
"Look, you really want to know why we're back?"
"I fucked up," Bruce said. Jane looked up at him, her brow furrowed into a network of thin lines. She lightly kicked at his foot, burning rays through him with her eyes. She didn't know how to play off this new narrative, and it almost sounded as if he was going to come right out and say it. "We think you're a murderer."
"You see," Bruce said after he let out a long breath, "I asked my girl here to marry me, and of course I received a sound answer, but the thing is, I have no ring. Now, we were already on the way up to New Hampshire to visit my parents, share the wonderful news, but how can I really do that with no ring?"
Jane relaxed. Her grasp on Bruce's arm loosened as she saw what he was trying to accomplish.
"So, you have any jewelry, Rusky? Something simple?" Bruce asked.
Rusky looked at the couple, eyes still narrowed. He reached up and scratched his stubble-filled chin, producing a sandpaper-like noise. After a long pause, he grabbed a small white tray from beneath the show counter in front of him and plopped it down on the display surface. 20 or so different rings, men's and women's, shone dully in the scant light.
Better have brought some cash back with you from when you first stopped by, Rusky said.
Oh, look,
Jane said, nudging Bruce in the ribs.
This one is beautiful.
She hoped her faux enthusiasm didn't set off any alarms. The ring she pointed to had a plain white gold band and a sizable heart-shaped diamond in the setting.
That one is nice, though I bet it's expensive, Bruce said and looked up at Rusky.
He studied the old man's face, looking for any tells that the curmudgeon might be onto their little stunt, but Rusky remained still, arms crossed against his chest, looking indifferently at the couple.
We could even get yours at the same time, hon. What do you think about that one?
Jane said, steadying a finger at a man's ring in the corner of the tray. Bruce saw what this ring looked like in his own mind before turning toward the tray corner. Gold, bordered by doves. The two of them looked at each other. They had seen enough.
How much for those two rings? I have my wallet in the car and...
Mark burst through the front door, coated in sweat, breathing in great heaves.
Guys, we need to go, now,
Mark said, trying to stay calm as his voice hitched between his gasps for air. Now, the trio looked at each other, frozen in place, then turned their heads to Rusky. He let out something between a laugh and a growl and slammed his hand on something below the sales counter. Steel bars came protruding through the ceiling, clamping into the ground at breakneck speed and sealing off the entrance to the shack. The old man produced a revolver from the back of his waistband, aiming it in their direction. No escape. No other way out except maybe beyond the man with a gun.
I don't think you're going anywhere, Rusky said.
He directed the group into the back room, which resembled a makeshift kitchen. A dirt-stained porcelain sink, no larger than a basketball, was mounted to one wall, and beside it, a small cupboard with a propane camp stove atop sat cockeyed. A small dormitory refrigerator sat against the wall, perpendicular to the cupboard 10 feet away. The walls were green, like gypsum, and waterlogged from years of humidity and condensation. In the middle of the room, there was a divider made from wrought iron mesh, the spacing in the mesh about a half inch in diameter. The smell of rotting flesh mixed with the sickly, cloying odor of blood, fouling the stale air. The room was poorly lit and messy with used dinner plates stacking up on a small table in the corner. Next to the dishes sat an open bag of zip ties.
Tie him up, Rusky said to Mark, motioning toward Bruce with the pistol.
Screw you, man, Mark said. What are you really going to do if I don't? Shoot me? Are you really going to shoot me?
Rusky looked Mark up and down, considering the question. He shrugged his bony, deformed shoulders.
Yes, he replied, dropping his aim to the meat of Mark's thigh and squeezing the trigger.
The pistol's deafening blast filled the room with acrid smoke. The bullet tore through Mark's quadriceps, allowing warm, dark blood to cover his jeans. He fell to the floor, clutching at the wound, screaming in anguish like a tied-up dog stuck in a patch of fire ants.
Now, tie them up or I'm going to shoot you again, but it won't be in the leg next time,
Rusky said, unaware the bullet had nicked Mark's femoral artery. And if the bleeding didn't stop soon, another gunshot wouldn't be necessary. He grabbed Mark by the arm and hoisted him to his feet, never letting the gun barrel wander too far from the other two. Mark took the zip ties from the bag on the table, laced one through the wrought iron mesh and around Bruce's wrist. The tie made a high-pitched swishing noise as it tightened, and Jane began to sob. Next, he zip-tied Jane. After Mark had completed his arduous task, Rusky grabbed another zip tie and secured his remaining victim, knowing the blood-soaked boy wouldn't put up much of a resistance. Instead, Mark looked into the old man's lunatic yellowing eyes and spat. Rusky wiped off the phlegmy saliva and chortled.
Oh, you must be stupid, boy. You shouldn't have done that,
Rusky said, jamming the barrel of the revolver deep into Mark's ashen neck.
No siree.
He set down his sidearm and went towards the back of the kitchen, returning with a dull, rusty butcher's knife.
You know what I do to people who disrespect me? People who spit in my face? I got 'em. After all, I am getting a little hungry,
Rusky said, a maniacal smile spreading across his whiskered face. Mark began to squirm against the metal mesh, thrashing his wrists, the zip ties digging deeper. Rusky lifted the blade to just below his prisoner's xiphoid process and slowly inserted it, ripping through the flesh and cartilage. Bruce and Jane dropped their heads and squeezed their eyes shut. The blade continued into Mark, making a sick cracking noise, scraping the end of his ribcage. After burying 3/4 of the knife into his victim, Rusky started ripping down the belly in rough, jagged hues, blood oozing out like used motor oil. Perhaps in a fit of shock, Mark remained stoic, not screaming, not crying, not moaning. The only thing moving was his mouth, opening and closing like a half-dead fish out of water. A wet laugh gurgled from Rusky's gullet as he continued the incision down to the belt line. The tatters of Mark's shirt were no longer striped and green, but a dark wet color, with pink and yellow glistening carrion where the cut stood. Rusky removed the knife and licked blood from the blade. After smacking his lips with his sandpapery tongue, he tossed aside the knife and reached both hands into Mark's gaping chest cavity. He tore away at the loose flesh of the belly and plunged farther into the open wound, grabbing for the intestines. He removed a mass of entrails, brought them to his crooked nose, and sniffed. Frowning, he ripped the rest of the handful of guts out and slammed them to the floor. Bruce bit his lower lip and kept quiet, feeling helpless and fearing he was next. He heard the wet slosh of Mark's inside smacking the dirty floor. Jane glanced at the noise, saw what was happening, gagged, then vomited a watery yellow stream. Rusky laughed again.
Just add to the stinking pile, my dear, he said.
You're a damn psychopath.
Jane bawled. Her face was red and wet. She looked at Bruce, and his glassy gaze remained on the floor. Maintaining eye contact with Jane, Rusky reached back into Mark's now lifeless body, seized on an organ, and ripped it free. The stringy gore that hung from the heart in Rusky's hand reminded Jane of the pulpy sinew from pulling the top off a carving pumpkin. He held the bloody mass in front of Jane's face, but she turned her head away. Grabbing her by the chin, he snapped her head back and made her watch as he took a mouthful out of the dead organ. Blood gushed out of the corners of his mouth, trickling down like little streaks of watery ketchup. He ground the meat up with his rotting teeth, mouth open. Jane screamed. Rusky swallowed and said,
Now, if I leave you two lovebirds alone, I trust you all won't get up to any funny business while I'm gone. I'm suddenly hungry for some brain food, and it's gonna take something mightier than a butcher knife to pop your friend's top off.
The old man grabbed his pistol and left back through the curtain and into the storefront. When he was out of sight, Bruce worked at sawing the plastic ties against the mesh.
Bruce,
Jane said, voice barely above a whisper.
He killed Mark.
Her sobs were calming, but the catch in her voice started to spike.
Mark's dead. He's going to kill us too, isn't he?
Bruce's wrists started to turn red from the friction of the zip ties, but he felt the metal shred the weakening plastic little by little, the only thing working in him now, the instinct to survive. He didn't think about the police and the questions about witnessing his best friend's murder. He wasn't reflecting upon the fact that he would be lucky if he ever got more than a few hours of sleep now for the rest of his life. Tiny streams of blood formed where the zip ties dug into his wrist. They continued to fray as he worked his hands back and forth in frantic swipes. His mind was only set on one thing: survival. It seemed Rusky had been gone for a while now. Bruce let out a loud groan, strained against his restraint, and busted the compromised zip tie. He rubbed at his aching wrists.
"Get me down,"
Jane said, hearing the snap. She tried to keep her eyes open and her head clear, but the shock started to take hold and the color drained from her face. Bruce grabbed the same knife that had moments before disemboweled his best friend, looked at it, hesitated, then cut the zip ties away from Jane's wrists. She fell into Bruce's body and he caught her. They embraced, knowing their time had to be limited, but lived in that small moment of warmth, support, and comfort. A moment of familiarity.
"Let's get the hell away from here, Bruce. Please."
Bruce put an arm around Jane, diverting his eyes from Mark's hanging corpse, trying to avoid the bodily things littered on the ground before them. His eyes darted to the front curtain, their only way out. As they hobbled forward, a cool steel barrel of a shotgun poked through the curtain. Bruce didn't have to see the rest to know who was on the other end. Rusky drew the curtain back with his free hand.
"Thought I heard something. Where do y'all think you're going? Am I not a good host?" he said.
"Look, we just don't want to die. My car, you can have it. Just don't kill us,"
Bruce said, removing his arm from Jane. He reached into his pocket, produced the keys to his Pontiac, and raised both hands into the air, inching toward Rusky. The old man smiled and nodded.
"Here, just take them,"
Bruce said, and threw the keys into Rusty's face. He came down on one knee, ducked his head from the gun's barrel and grabbed it at the same time, performed a sweeping kick, and knocked Rusky to the ground. Bruce's goal had been to avoid a face full of birdshot, or whatever the shotgun was loaded with, but instead, the weapon clattered to the floor near his feet. He grabbed it. A new sense of power fell over him as he stood up, hovered over the old man, and pointed the barrel into his face.
"Oh, now what are you gonna do, boy? Shoot me? Fucking coward you are,"
Rusky said. Bruce swallowed hard, a dry click in his throat bounced through his head. He had never killed anyone before. Hell, he had never even fired a gun, but was fairly confident he grasped the concept. And anyway, it didn't matter. This ended now. "Good night, Rusky," Bruce said, and squeezed the trigger. Click. That was it. Click. No boom, no smoke filling the air around them, no smell of gunpowder, just click. At first, Bruce figured the safety was on, like in those cheesy action movies when the bad guy steals the good guy's gun and tries to kill him with it. His thumb felt for the safety toggle, like a blind man feeling for a doorknob. He found it. Hope and strength washed over him in waves. But he looked down at the toggle and saw that it was already set to fire, the red dot staring up at him.
"That thing hasn't worked since the day I took it off the man I killed for it. Hell of a distraction, though. Always told myself I'd get her smithed one day," Rusky said. "Go on, try it again."
Bruce pulled the trigger once more to another empty click. Rusky bellowed a guttural guffaw and started to get back to his feet. Jane snatched the gun from the bewildered Bruce. She gripped it by the barrel and brought the stock down on Rusky's face in a fast swoop. He let out a grunt, then staggered, surprised by the magnitude of the blow.
"Let's go,"
Jane said, taking hold of Bruce's hand. He swiped his car keys off the floor with the other, ready to get the fuck out. They went through the curtain and pushed past the ramshackle racks of clothing and knickknacks toward the front door, hoping they could get the bars blocking the exit free from their holds. Bruce glanced behind him, knocking over a table full of old screwdrivers and wrenches, and saw Rusky again rising to his feet. A blow like that should have incapacitated a man of his age, he thought. Rusky swayed, stumbled after the couple.
You stupid kids! There's no way out, he said.
Between them, the sales counter acted as a barrier, keeping each party at bay. Bruce and Jane had their backs up against the bars barricading the door, pinned like animals. Rusky circled the counter, retrieving his six-shooter, now secured in a shoulder holster, from a shelf beneath. He laced his arms through the leather hoops and unlatched the holster strap. The droning buzz from the neon signs hanging in the dirty window behind them seemed to give call to Bruce, and he lunged toward the old man, aiming to leap the counter and grab for the gun. His feet, however, never gave purchase, and he slipped on the wax-worn linoleum and sprawled onto the floor. Jane rushed forward and grabbed the back of Bruce's shirt, trying to pull him back to his feet. Neither of them noticed Rusky round the counter until he had a fistful of Jane's damp hair. He pulled up and yanked her into his body, her face contorting as she screamed in pain. He pulled out his pistol, held it to her temple, and wrapped an arm around her neck, ending her bid for escape.
"Let her go!"
Bruce said, voice cracking. His breathing became heavy. Beads of sweat rolled down his face as he crab-walked into the sales counter.
"Don't worry, boy. I ain't gonna shoot her. Ain't really my style. So impersonal, don't you think? Only reason I shot your buddy is 'cause he wouldn't play by the rules," Rusky said, holstering his gun.
Jane's eyes met Bruce's. They were wide and bloodshot, but it was the screwdriver in her left hand that Bruce focused on.
"No, not my style at all. Think I'll cut her instead. Sound good to you, boy?" Rusky asked.
He reached into his pants pocket with his free hand and retrieved a switchblade. He pressed the button on the handle and the knife swung out and locked into place. The silver blade felt cool on Jane's neck as he pressed it into the soft flesh of her throat.
"Sure you want to watch?" Rusky asked Bruce.
Bruce felt helpless. He could do nothing. If he tried to make a move, Rusky would plunge the knife into his girlfriend. If he did nothing, Rusky would cut her still the same. He hoped she could get enough leverage to land the screwdriver in her fist into the old man and get free of his grasp. It was then their eyes met again, and he saw her raise the screwdriver up and blindly land it into the leg of her captor. She drove it in farther still and twisted it, but he did not let her go. Rusky bellowed and grasped for the handle protruding from his thigh, falling back, stunned. Jane thrashed about in his weakening grip and bit into the forearm wrapped around her neck. Rusky screamed again, dropped his hold on Jane, but in the same motion, brought the switchblade up and slashed deep into her neck, tearing it open. The flesh hung slack like raw bacon. Blood flowed down past her collarbone and soaked into her blouse. She dropped to her knees and grasped at her neck with both hands. As she began to drop, Bruce regained his footing and dove at Rusky, but was a step too late to halt the attack on Jane. He crashed into the old man, rattling the bars securing the front door. Bruce popped up and crawled on his knees toward Jane, who remained posted up in a sitting position against the wall, spitting up globs of red.
"Jane, we have to get out of here,"
Bruce said as he grabbed his girlfriend under her arms. Rusky squirmed and grunted mere feet away from them, working on prying the screwdriver from his leg. One of the steel bars worked free of its hold after the collision it sustained with the two men. Bruce hobbled toward Rusky and the front door, still holding up Jane, whose face looked like a waxen doll. Bruce brought his foot down on the handle of the screwdriver and forced it deeper into Rusky's leg. By now, the leg looked like a strawberry jam pincushion. He began again to wail, but was cut short as Bruce used his foot to knock the old man out of the way of the door, connecting his heel with the old man's nose. He let out a muffled cry and fell limp to the floor. Blood pooled on the linoleum. Bruce rattled the other steel bars protecting the door, but they didn't move. He glanced around the small shop, looking for something heavy enough to break the glass on the window next to the door. His eyes landed on the sales counter. For the most part, the counter was empty, nothing heavy enough to aid in their escape. But for a moment, clarity returned to the foggy haze that filled his brain. The button. Of course, the button! Under the sales counter, he remembered the old man slamming a button that made the steel bars fall from the ceiling. He gently laid Jane down on the floor and rounded the counter. The button stood out, attached to the side of the shelving underneath the cash register. He pushed it and looked up at the bars. They didn't move. He pushed it again. Nothing. He tapped the button as hard as he could, cursing to himself as the bars remained in their hold. Bruce heard a groaning noise and looked up to see Rusky moving. Why isn't this working? He dropped down to eye level with the button and saw a little nub set down in a recessed area of the pad. He pushed it up like a light switch and heard a click. A salty copper taste filled his mouth. Must have bit the inside of my lip, he thought. He sometimes chewed the insides of his cheeks until they bled, a nervous habit he hadn't practiced since he was a child. This time, when Bruce pushed the button, the steel bars disappeared into the ceiling. Rusky groaned again, knowing what the noise was. He grabbed a table near him, trying to hoist himself to his feet. Bruce ran back to Jane, picked her up, and opened the front door with his back as he dragged his girlfriend out into the gravel parking lot. Rusky unsuccessfully swiped an arm at them as they made their way outside. The couple reached the Pontiac. Bruce pulled open the passenger door, slid Jane into the seat, and sped around to the driver's side, sliding in the loose gravel. He started the old car, and as it roared to life, he punched the accelerator, back tires spitting up dirt and gravel. He looked into the rearview mirror and saw the front door swing open again. It's going to be all right. We'll get you to a hospital, and you'll be all right. Just please stay with me, Jane, Bruce said as tears started to well up in his eyes. The car thundered away down the county road that originally led them to the damned shack. It was slick and shiny in the moonlight. Had it rained while we were in there? Bruce supposed it was a possibility. There were other pressing matters keeping them occupied. He looked up into the rear view again and saw a shape appearing in the scant light. It grew larger until Bruce could see it was a motorcycle. An old man on a motorcycle. At that moment, things began to run together. Noises, sights, direction. Bruce remembered hearing 4, maybe 5 gunshots. Why didn't I grab his gun when he was out on the floor? He saw the sparks like little tracers from the stray rounds. Wait, did I hear something hit the car? A thud and pop. The tire blew out. The car skidded out of control. Bruce saw a deer and mashed the brake pedal. The car slid sideways, wiping out the deer before slamming into a giant oak. The front end of the car danced with flames. Bruce felt his legs, back, and neck start to throb in aching spasms. He looked out and saw Rusky 10 yards away on the motorcycle. Another gunshot. Bruce smelled the familiar odor of gasoline and screamed. Bright orange and yellow light blinded him as a deafening sound ruptured his eardrums. He felt heat. Rusky sped away, back towards the shack. Dark had fallen completely, and the old man could see a faint orange glow off in the distance when he turned into his gravel parking lot. He stared at the fire as if in a trance. It held his attention. He couldn't look away. Not even the throbbing pulse of pain from the hole in his leg, caused by that little bitch, could distract him. He looked on for 10 minutes, which became 20, and soon 30, until finally deciding to go back inside and begin cleaning up. Before he made it through the door, Rusky heard the crunch of gravel behind him.
Cops already?
No, that couldn't be right. He didn't hear a car pull in, much less a piercing siren, reflecting its cool blue and red off the foliage around the shack. He turned around, expecting perhaps another deer, but saw a man instead, staggering toward him, a blanket of blood covering most of his face.
"Where the hell you come from? I fucking killed you! I know I did!"
Rusky said, rubbing at his old yellow eyes. Bruce limped closer to the old man. His shirt was seared down the right side, and a portion of his hair had melted to his scalp. One eye, puffy and bruised, looked like it might never open again. The blast had thrown him through the windshield, which had mostly broken out from the impact of the tree. He had time to unlatch his seatbelt before the explosion, which propelled him into the water-filled ditch, soothing the scorched portions of his body. If the blast had knocked him unconscious, he would have drowned, Rusky being none the wiser. Instead, Bruce now stood face to face with the man who had gutted his best friend, killed his girlfriend, and came near to taking his own life. Blood trickled from his mouth as he began to talk.
"You have no clue what you took from me," Bruce said, edging closer.
He spat part of a tooth into the gravel.
"I want you to beg for your life before I take it."
"You ain't taking shit from me, boy," Rusky said.
He reached down for his pistol. He knew he had another round left, was pretty sure of it anyway, and started to grin. But his hand grazed an empty holster. The smile faded from his face as he looked down.
"Looking for this, old man?"
Bruce asked, holding the revolver up to Rusky's face.
"I suppose your holster works much better when the safety strap's fastened. Oh, I still would have come back had I not found the gun. I would have bashed your head in with one of your ornamental balls out here if I had to. But finding this on the road after I crawled out of the ditch? Instant karma, wouldn't you say?"
Rusky realized his mistake and cursed himself. He looked at the boy aiming the pistol at his face and asked yet again,
"What are you gonna do now, eh? Shoot me?"
The old man launched into a fit of laughter as if he had heard the funniest thing ever spoken between two people. He closed his eyes and his laughs wove in and out of several hectic coughing spats. Bruce gripped the pistol with both hands and wrapped the pad of his pointer finger around the pistol's trigger. As he squeezed, Bruce began to scream. His throat became raw, his own blood coating his vocal cords as the blast from the revolver tore through the silent night. Rusky's body flew backward, landing in a lifeless heap on the gravel. Bruce's finger continued dry-firing the pistol, but the empty clicking noise was masked by his screams. Finally, Bruce stopped. He dropped to his knees beside the dead man, and the gun tumbled from his grip. He put his hands to his face and wept. After. Bruce set the bouquet of white roses on a patch of earth next to Jane's headstone. His mind tried and failed to wrap itself around everything that happened in the past 2 weeks. He glided along as if in autopilot as he attempted to rebuild the shattered pieces of his young life. Tomorrow, he would fly back home and perform the same morbid ritual for Mark, helping carry his best friend to an open hole in the ground where eventually he'd turn to dust.
"Why couldn't it have just been me?"
It seemed like every newspaper on the East Coast had been hounding him, calling and leaving messages at all hours of the day and night. Right now, though, he wasn't talking to anyone. Not his family, not any friends, and certainly not reporters. He'd find his voice again someday, but for now, He lived with the guilt of being alive and took solace in the silence. He ran his hand over the top of the gravestone. The granite, a red and black cottage blend, felt smooth and cool to the touch. He closed his eyes and pictured Jane, smiling at him with the bright sun kissing her bare shoulders. After the investigation was settled, state troopers and the FBI found that William Brookfield Ruskin had murdered over 26 people, including the young bride and groom from the photos on the disposable camera, based on remains found on his property. Other missing persons that fit the geographical profile and timeline had had their possessions recovered from his roadside shop, but their bodies were never found. The investigators were able to pinpoint ownership of the higher-valued items. Ruskin never bothered to scratch VIN numbers off the vehicles he took from his victims and narrowed down his methodology. It was simple enough. Lure unsuspecting campers and passerby with the promise of last-minute needful things, kill the weakest of his customers, then steal their valuables to use as products in his store. The cycle repeated itself for years. Most of the folks gathered at the gravesite meandered back to their cars, ready to travel the short distance to the dining hall to have a celebration of life for Jane. Bruce glanced around and figured he ought to be leaving as well. He had to catch a red eye to Jacksonville. He looked down at the grave a final time, kissed his hand, and put it down on the granite. A thick gray storm cloud rolled in and blocked out the sun. He hoped the weather would be better in Florida. You've been listening to The Shack by A.W. Mason. A.W. Mason lives in Florida with his cats Wallace and Belle, retired extreme parkour artists who look so dapper in their little helmets and knee pads. He enjoys all the nachos, getting lost in the woods, and naps. Mason has published several books, including A Haunt of Travels, The Cleanup Crew, The Scampering, co-authored with Alana K. Drex, and Judy Martin's Final Curtain Call. His short stories have appeared in various anthologies. You can find more of his work through Velox Books, www.veloxbooks.com. Nothing like cruising through the countryside with some friends on a nice summer day. That being said, as someone who has spent a decent amount of time driving through rural Pennsylvania, I can tell you, listeners, that this one isn't too far-fetched. In fact, the only thing that really put a dent in my suspension of disbelief is that they didn't stop at a Sheetz or a Wawa somewhere. Oh well, I suppose there's always next time. Well, for Bruce, at least. Thank you all for joining me this fine evening, and thanks also go to A.W. Mason and Velux Books for tonight's story. I also can't forget to thank Danielle Hewitt again for providing her voice talents. I'll be back next week with a fun little double feature, so be sure to come back. Until then, friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.